Hi, this is Austin Hill. Hey, thanks for checking out this podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. Now, you can hear our program live weekday morning, 6 till 8 Central Time. There are many more podcasts for this and all our Faith Radio shows. They're available online. Our web address, of course, myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. And thanks for your gifts to this listener-supported ministry. Enjoy the podcast.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the Morning.
Good morning. It's 7:04. Welcome to it. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill here weekday mornings, 6 till 8, where we talk about things that really do matter as we seek to connect our faith to our daily lives and make sense of a world gone awry through a Christian worldview. By the way, did I say it was 7:04? Sorry, we have the clock here in the studio set to the wrong time zone. Here we go. There we go. Phew! Boy, I thought we were headed back to the future. Anyway, it's 6:04 Central Time, and I'm glad you're with us. Coming up later this morning, we have some big news that we need to take in. I'll try to make sense of this for you over the course of the last 24 hours. And quite frankly, just during business hours last week, we saw a couple of conflicting court rulings here in the United States regarding the federal Obamacare law, or the Affordable Care Act, as it's more formally known. And the fact of the matter is that if you or somebody you know, members of your family, are relying on the taxpayer-funded government subsidies to purchase health insurance, that was a big part of the Obamacare agenda and system, if you will. It's anybody's guess exactly whether or not those will be in place next year or 6 months from now or even 8 or 9 months from now. We don't know. There was a federal appeals court that determined that the ways in which the taxpayer-funded subsidies were being dispersed was unconstitutional. Another federal appeals court, and these were pretty in close geographic proximity from one another. A court in the District of Columbia, a federal appeals court, says this is unconstitutional. In Virginia, a federal appeals court says, nope, we reject the ruling from the D.C. court. Let's move on with this. All that to say that there's more uncertainty surrounding how people will get their taxpayer-funded subsidy for health care. And this could create some real consternation and quite frankly, suffering in the lives of individuals and families. So we'll try to break that down for you a little bit later this morning. Also, some good news about marriages in America. Now, we've got this good news on our blog page at myfaithradio.com, our mobile-friendly website, myfaithradio.com. And this came to us from a guest, a lady that you probably heard on the Faith Radio Network many, many times before. And she's just such a prolific author and speaker and has quite a voice in our world today. Shanti Feldhahn is the lady's name. I'm going to let you hear some of her remarks with some very interesting statistics that she's been compiling for nearly a decade now on marriage in America. And this notion that is commonly repeated, I've heard this from church pulpits, from all different circles, this notion that half or more of all marriages, even within the context of the Christian community and within the church itself, half of all marriages end in divorce. Shanti Feldhahn says, not so. And she makes the case that we should all be heartened and encouraged by the reality that is borne out from statistics. So I'll tell you about that coming up here in just a few moments. Also, raising confident sons and secure daughters. Got some great parenting advice, some great insight from yet another prolific author and great voice among the Christian community. His name is Glenn Stanton. He's got a new book out about secure daughters and confident sons. And as a parent myself, I'm trying to grab on to any good wisdom in that category that I can find. So all this and more just ahead here on Austin Hill in the Morning. When we come back, we'll let you hear some of the remarks made actually yesterday on our broadcast by Shanti Feldhahn. This is indeed a game changer in terms of how people perceive the institution of marriage, but can be a game changer in terms of how people view their own personal marriage, their individual relationship with their spouse. Tell you about it coming up next. 608, this is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Thank you for being here. Thank you for partnering with us, being a supporter of the Faith Radio Network. Find us anytime at our mobile-friendly website. It's myfaithradio.com. I'm Austin Hill here weekday morning, 6 till 8. Now, yesterday, we can't have her with us live real-time every day, but it bears repeating some of the remarks that she made yesterday. Shanti Feldhahn, S-H-A-U-N-T-I.com, Shanti.com is how you can find her online. Shanti Feldhahn, who, by the way, has a background as an economist and worked as a statistician and keeping track of analyst data on Wall Street for many, many years before she got into writing about broader issues of culture. Shanti Feldhahn has, for, she says, about 8 years now, been collecting data on the status of marriage in America. Now, the starting point for our discussion is the reality that there is another great research group. It's called the Barna Group, headed up by a researcher named George Barna. George Barna, for probably 30 years or more now, has been yet another prolific voice and very influential voice in terms of conducting polling and collecting data on perceptions and opinions among Christians in America. And he also surveys non-Christians as well, but he has focused his research, the Barna Research Group, has focused most of their research on the perceptions and opinions of Christians in America, different attitudes and preferences that largely the evangelical Christian community holds about any of a number of issues. Well, George Barna, many, many years ago, did a survey about marriage. And from the results of his survey, it has been oft-repeated, and I said it before, I've heard this, I've had pastors tell me this personally, I've heard it in pulpits, I heard this notion repeated that roughly 50% of all marriages in America end in divorce, and that's true among American Christians as well as everybody else. Well, Shanti Feldhahn actually partnered with the Barna Research Group to start collecting this data about marriage for almost a decade. This has gone on for almost 8 years. That's kind of the starting point of the story. Here's part one of our discussion yesterday with Shanti Feldhahn here on the program. Listen to this.
You know, it's interesting. It is really easy to talk about the biggest threat to marriage being divorce and all of our ministries and our efforts trying to prevent divorce. And believe me, I'm right in there. You know, that's a lot of my work is trying to help people understand the things that'll help their marriages succeed. But you know, what I realized truly, it's not divorce that's the greatest threat. It's discouragement. That's what leads to divorce. All the ministries that we've got, it's really about bringing hope. And that is what we're lacking in our culture. You know, everybody thinks of marriage as being this institution that's broken. Well, you know what? Despite all we've done to kill it, as I've seen these statistics, I realize this institution God created, it still works, despite all we've done to try to break it.
Well, let's talk about the implications specifically among Christians. What is this? How is this a game changer among Christian churches, even just in America?
Well, you know, we've all heard our pastors say that the rate of divorce is the same in the church. And I will tell you, behind the scenes, our pastors are discouraged. You know, I speak at about maybe 50 churches a year, something like that. Mm-hmm. And I talk to a lot of these guys, you know, behind the scenes in the green room, and they tell me, behind the scenes, that has sucked the life out of them, because they stand on stage and they look out over their congregation and they say, if it's true that the rate of divorce here, despite all my hard work, is the same as it is out there, it means all my work doesn't mean very much.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, I mean, think about how discouraging that would be. And the truth is so different. And we have been truly dealing with a major misunderstanding. And so here's what it is. Everybody thinks that George Barna found that the rate of divorce is the same in the church, and he didn't. That isn't even what he was trying to study. George Barna never studied people in the church. What he was only studying was belief systems.
Mm-hmm.
So when you call people on the phone and you ask the "Are you a Christian?" questions, the people who said, "Yes, I'm a Christian," or I'm a Muslim, or no, I'm an atheist. You know, those people, those groups had the same divorce rates. But Barna specifically excluded whether they went to church from the analysis, because that wasn't what he was trying to study. So what I did is I partnered with Barna, and I bought their data. And we reran all those numbers, but just with the one thing added in of, you know, was the person in church last week? And if they were, the divorce rate dropped by 27%.
Jeez. All right, so that's part one of my conversation yesterday with Shanti Feldhahn. When we come back, she actually gets to the truth of the matter. We've established that there's a lot of misperceptions and a lot of inaccurate notions about the state of marriage in America. When we come back, you'll hear her sort of dispel those myths and get to the heart of the matter. It's actually very encouraging news, very hopeful news. 6:16, this is Austin Hill in the Morning on the Faith Radio Network. We're glad you're here. Good morning, and thank you for listening to the Faith Radio Network. I am Austin Hill. Still to come, what does the shakeup with the federal Obamacare program mean for you? If you are relying, or somebody in your family is relying on the federal government subsidies to buy health insurance, could be a disruption. It could go away altogether. We simply do not know as the federal law gets tried in the judiciary, in the courts of our country. We'll update you on that later this morning. Also, raising confident sons. I'm the father of a teenage son, and that's very important to me. And secure daughters. Author of a great new book on the subject, Glenn Stanton, joins us later this morning. Plus, Christians responding to inner-city urban violence in America. Talk to a pastor who's on the front lines of that coming up in about 15 minutes from now. Shanti Feldhahn is the author of a great new book. It's all about good news about marriage. Here she is from our discussion yesterday. She reiterates that people's perceptions about how frequently and how often marriages end in divorce, it's just wrong, and we should be encouraged by the realities. Roll it. This notion that, quote-unquote, 50% of all marriages end in divorce.
Yeah.
I hear that reiterated from pulpits by pastors, or at least I certainly have over the years. Are we discouraging good marriages in the church?
Yes, we definitely are. Because here's what happens, and you've probably seen this, I'm sure your listeners have seen this, is that when somebody is really discouraged already in their marriage, you know, once they start thinking we're not going to make it, it becomes really easy to think, well, you know, 50% of other people couldn't make it either. So, and it makes it really easy to give up.
Mm-hmm.
And as I started looking at these numbers, I realized what I was seeing was this, it's still not perfect, but it's massively good news. Let me give you an example.
Please.
One of the things, let's talk about the 50% divorce rate, for example. One of the things that I found that is a very, very good number from the Census Bureau. This is not some little sideline study, by the way. But according to the Census Bureau, as you and I are sitting here talking, 71% of people are still married to their first spouse.
That's a pretty big deal.
It's a huge deal. I'm like, why haven't we heard this before? And the 29% that aren't, a big chunk of that is actually people that were married for 50 years and their spouse died.
Mm-hmm.
That's just marriages that have ended. Now, and here's the problem, Austin. We don't know what the first marriage divorce rate actually is, and I think that's the reason the myths get started, you know, because we're kind of a soundbite culture.
Very much.
And so we don't know exactly, but we can get closer. There's some different things, like there's about a 14% rate of widowhood. There's some various things that play in. But we can estimate that, you know, it has to be less than 29%, because that's death and divorce. We can estimate it's probably closer to somewhere like 20 to 25% of first marriages. Now, that's still too high, but it's a whole lot better. And it means that you can look a couple that's getting married in the eye. You can look somebody that's having trouble in the eye and say, you know what? Most marriages are strong and happy for a lifetime. You can get through this, because most people do.
Hmm.
Completely different feeling that that couple is going to have.
Very interesting perspective, wouldn't you say? I mean, that is that not a game changer? Now, in Section 3, and by the way, if you just joined us, this is our conversation with Shanti Feldhahn from yesterday's episode of our program. You can hear the full discussion, unfettered, in its entirety, on our mobile-friendly website at myfaithradio.com. Here in this final section, I ask her how marriage and divorce has sort of ebbed and flowed relative to economic conditions, and how do we get this this encouraging news out to people? Roll it.
The economics of splitting up is one of the things that keeps people together. But it actually turns out to be a good thing, because if you stay together for 6 months just because the economics would be difficult, you might find you like each other again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's actually one of the things that leads to reconciliation. That's some other things, other research that I've done over the years. Just hanging out together. It really, as long as you're hanging out as friends and you're trying to spend time together, you kind of rediscover why you liked each other to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in answer to your question, though, it's really interesting. Yes. Technically, people were more staying together because it would cost too much to split up. And so technically, yes, there's probably been a small increase now that things have gotten better in some of those people moving ahead with divorce. But it's fascinating how the news makes something really big, a really big story, out of something that's really not that big in numbers. And it leads to this perception of this wave of divorces. The reality is the divorce rates have continued to go down. So, yes, there's probably some people for whom they delayed it and they went ahead and took that step. But divorce rates overall have continued to decline.
Mm.
And a lot of people aren't aware of that. They're not aware of the fact that, yeah, we had a spike in divorces in the 1970s when no-fault divorce came into being. You know, because it started getting easy to get a divorce.
Sure.
You didn't have to convince somebody there was a reason. But that hit a peak in 1980 because people saw very quickly the chaos that that caused. And the divorce rates have come down more than 30% since then. People aren't aware of the fact that we've had, yeah, we still have these issues, but we've had some really good trends that are worth celebrating and telling people, yeah, you know what, you might have a close friend that got divorced. You might have had somebody in your church that had a moral failure, you know, and that's tragic, and it does happen. But those are the exceptions. Those aren't the rules. We have to get people thinking again about the fact that, you know, most marriages today, they're not perfect, but they truly are lasting a lifetime.
It's very profound. Shanti Feldhahn is the name of that lady you hear speaking there. You can find her at her website. The domain is very simple. It's just her first name, S-H-A-U-N-T-I, Shanti.com. Her new book, of course, all about some really big news. I mean, the good news about marriage. You can hear the full discussion that we had with her yesterday and details about her and her book at MyFaithRadio.com. Indeed, that just doing the facts is a game changer, wouldn't you say? 6:25. This is Austin Hill in the Morning. Still to come, Christians in America responding to inner-city urban violence. We'll talk to a pastor who's on the front lines of that in Chicago. Also, raising secure daughters and confident sons in a world gone awry. As a parent, I'm trying to take in all the wisdom I can on that. We'll hear from an author of a great new book on the subject. All this and more just ahead. It's the Faith Radio Network. Thank you for being with us. This is the Austin Hill in the Morning program, Connecting Faith. You hear that weekdays at noon with Neil Stavem. And yesterday on Neil's program, he was interviewing Cal Beisner of a group called the Cornwall Alliance. They were discussing stewardship of the earth and biblical stewardship of the earth and creation. Listen as Cal Beisner shares his insights on the current quote-unquote climate change debate.
I think I did just see that out the other day that, the global temperatures are up or something, the warmest they've been. So when we see something like that, I mean, even if it is presented as it's supposedly just as a factual statement, but somehow we read it and go, oh, well, this obviously is buttressing the case that climate change is happening.
Yeah, I saw recently this claim that June was the warmest month that we've had on record.
Yeah.
There are some interesting questions to ask about that sort of thing. Which particular data set are you looking at? There are a variety of different ones to consider. Some of them will perhaps support that. Some of them will not. But another question is, what's the record that you have in mind? How long does that record go back? Because if it's talking, for instance, about the satellite record, measuring Earth's atmospheric temperatures from satellites, that only goes back to 1979. We know for sure, for instance, that 1934 was significantly warmer than the warmest year since the recent global warming started in 1977. That year was 1998. We know for sure, that the medieval warm period, running from about 800 or 900 to about 1200 AD, got warmer than the present has been. So there are all sorts of questions to ask about that. And then besides that, you know, frankly, I don't know any skeptics of global warming, and I would count myself one. I don't know any who don't agree that there has been global warming in the last 150 years or so. We've been coming out of a little ice age, which went from about 1350 to 1850, and we've been trending upward. Now, when you trend upward for a while, it's normal. It is mathematically necessary that recent times will be warmer than less recent times. So even if we've hit a plateau, there's been no statistically significant warming for the last 17 years and 10 months. Nonetheless, any given month during that period on the plateau is going to be warmer than months before you reach the plateau. And then besides that, too, there's actually been some very, very slight cooling from about 2001 to the present in terms of global average temperature on an annual basis.
Cal, say a word about God's creation that surrounds us in which we live and how we are sufficiently cared for if we use it wisely.
Yeah, one thing we need to be careful about is that we don't think of this earth as a terribly fragile place. If you Google the words fragile and environment together, you'll come up with literally millions of hits. Because much of the environmental movement thinks of the environment, and, for instance, of the climate system, as extremely fragile, which is why they're worried that a doubling of CO2 concentration in the atmosphere, which, hey, doubling sounds big until you realize that would be from 28,000ths of 1% of the atmosphere to 54,000ths of 1% of the atmosphere. They think that doubling could cause catastrophic climate change. I don't think that's consistent with the biblical understanding that an infinitely wise and omniscient God designed the earth and its climate system. An omnipotent God created the earth and its climate system, and a faithful God sustains it. And this God promised himself in Genesis chapter 8 that as long as heaven and earth endure, summer and winter, day and night, seed time and harvest, cold and heat will not cease. That is, the various different cycles on which life depends, God has promised to sustain. Doesn't mean we can't do anything damaging to the environment, but it does mean that we need to be careful not to expect huge, disastrous results from tiny, tiny impacts on the environment.
Very interesting. Cal Beisner of the Cornwall Alliance for the Stewardship of Creation, a guest of Neil Staven on Connecting Faith yesterday during the noon hour. Coming up today at 12 noon, How Do We End Poverty? Author Victor Boutros joins Neil on Connecting Faith to take on that issue. And as we continue here on Austin Hill in the Morning, Christians responding to inner city urban violence. We'll talk to a pastor who's on the front lines in Chicago. I'll do that coming up next. It's 6:31. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. This is Austin Hill in the Morning. It's the Faith Radio Network. Still to come, raising secure daughters and confident sons. Well, we can't have enough secure daughters and confident sons. Author Glenn Stanton joins us into the second hour of this episode to talk about his latest book on the subject. Also, we'll have more to say about what sense we can make, if any, about the chaos and uncertainty surrounding the federal Obamacare initiative and the taxpayer-funded subsidies that a lot of people are relying on to acquire health insurance. All this and more just ahead here on Austin Hill in the Morning. With all the news coverage as of late over the invasion of children and adults alike from Latin America at the U.S.-Mexico border and what to do with these people who are impoverished and endangered, how about those who are already in our country? How about our fellow Americans who are endangering one another? It's quite a problem in our country, especially in the region of Chicago, Illinois, surrounding urban inner-city violence. I want you to listen to this audio. This is commonplace. This is everyday kind of stuff, if you will. This comes to us from WLS-TV, ABC 7 News in Chicago just the other day. Roll it.
The gunman was reportedly armed with an automatic weapon. So let's get the latest on this from Eyewitness News reporter Jessica D'Onofrio in Chicago Heights.
Alan, police tell me they are interviewing witnesses and trying to come up with leads, but so far, no one is in custody. Latricia Bell says her 23-year-old son, Daniel Washington, was playing dice with his two cousins when shots rang out last night on the corner of Division and Concord in Chicago Heights. She says she saw at least four men get out of a car and spray bullets down the block. Her son was shot twice in the leg and is recovering. His 23-year-old cousin is in serious condition with multiple bullet wounds. The other cousin, an 18-year-old, was grazed in the head.
It was a nice neighborhood. It was. But now, I just don't know.
It was a nice neighborhood, but now we just don't know. It seems to be a common refrain in Chicago and other urban epicenters around the country. Joining us to talk about it, a man who is at the epicenter of it all, longstanding media personality in the Chicagoland area. He is the pastor of a church in the suburb of Oak Park. Cisco Cotto is on the guest line. Cisco Cotto, welcome to our program of the Faith Radio Network. Thanks for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Austin. It's great to be with you today.
Good to talk to you. Listen, that news audio there, that's very common stuff for you. You have reported the news in the Chicago area. Now you are a pastor serving a congregation. Give us your perspective on this problem that has been present for a long time in the Chicago area but is getting worse.
Yeah, listening to that clip, that really is the everyday in certain neighborhoods here in Chicago. You have, and I just want everyone listening to sort of imagine this. You're a parent of young children. You live in a neighborhood, not necessarily because you want to, but because genuinely it's all that you can afford. You just can't move. And every day, regardless of what those kids are doing, whether they're playing out in the front yard or they're walking to or from school or they're even laying in their bed at night in their house sleeping, no matter what those kids are doing, they might get hit by a stray bullet. I mean, the fear that's going on in these families, the uncertainty, I mean, it's a war zone in a lot of these neighborhoods. And the police say they're doing everything they can. The parents aren't so sure, and they just wish that there was some way that they could live in a safe neighborhood.
Cisco Cotto, with all the national news attention having been paid to the plight of illegal immigrants coming into our border and the big debate, which is a worthy debate, I would argue, gosh, do we respond to this from a legalistic, enforce the border laws sort of approach, or do we respond to this as a humanitarian crisis? I would argue that both of those issues are valid. But with all the national emphasis on this, is the plight of one of our nation's largest, oldest cities kind of being ignored in your view?
Well, every day, whether it's here locally, obviously there's media who are covering it. Nationally, I mean, you're hearing about it. People all around the world are hearing about this. My wife and I were recently in the United Kingdom, and in both Scotland and England, we had people asking us, what's going on with that violence in Chicago? I mean,
really?
It's widely reported, and I hope that the leaders in Chicago, Mayor Emanuel and others, know this. That's the reputation that Chicago is getting all around the world. You're really seeing, and I notice this as a believer in Christ, you are seeing in many respects the limits of what people can accomplish outside of Christ. You're seeing the limits of secular government. You're seeing the limits of secular methods. to control a situation like this. I recently gathered with a bunch of pastors, and these are pastors from dangerous neighborhoods and safe neighborhoods and even pastors from the suburbs. We gathered in downtown Chicago, and we just prayed for what was going on in this city, realizing it's spiritual warfare, realizing that this is so beyond anything that men and women can just handle on their own. We gathered together to pray, and I want you to know, Austin, this wasn't a pray, you know, like we do sometimes before dinner, you know, where it's sometimes it can seem like a throwaway prayer.
Mm.
These are men crying out to God, begging God to work a miracle in these neighborhoods, because we just acknowledged without God doing something big, there's just nothing people are going to be able to do to fix it.
Very interesting. Cisco Cotto, he is the pastor of a church in the Chicago area. He's on our guest line here on the Faith Radio Network, as he's giving us his perspective, some insight as to this rising tide of violence and murderous behavior in that city. Your church, give us an idea, Cisco, how your church is positioned to respond to inner city Chicago.
We are in a really unique position in that we are not in one of the neighborhoods that's really dealing with this violence, but we are just blocks away. We are less than a quarter of a mile away. And so we're not engaged in the everyday of literally having to figure out, okay, how are we gonna dodge stray bullets? We're not involved in that. But we are involved with people who, whether it's Sunday morning or for other events, are leaving the neighborhood looking for some respite, looking for prayer, looking for some sort of support in what they're doing. And as I mentioned earlier, I mean, churches are, you're sort of limited when you're in the middle of a war zone.
Mm-hmm.
You're sort of limited in what you can do. I don't have that kind of training. I don't have the ability to go in and try to handle it from a police standpoint. So what we do is boots on the ground, helping people understand that God, even in the midst of this war zone, God is there, and we have to trust Him and beg Him to change something. That's what we've been doing as a church, which, if you don't understand the power of God, that seems very inadequate. But then when you grasp what God can really do, you realize ultimately that's really the only thing that you can hold on to.
Hmm. Cisco Cotto, give us an idea of who the warring factions are. And maybe it's so duplicitous, maybe there's so many warring factions here that you can't really spell it out. But again, as we see news headlines, as we talk about broad-based current events in our world, the tension between Israel and the Palestinians. Well, that's very complex, but you can wrap your minds around it. How do we understand who's at war with whom in the Chicago area and the war that's leading all this violence? Who's sniping at who?
It's a lot of gangs who are fighting over drug turf. That's not the only way to describe it, but that is a big part of what's going on. Gangs who are making millions of dollars selling drugs, and if someone is in any way encroaching on their territory, their way of handling it is not, hey, let's get on the phone and have a talk, or let's go and grab a cup of coffee and see how we can work this out, or even let's go get lawyers, obviously, because you're dealing with illegal activity. Their way of handling it is get a gun, find the person, and shoot them to end the problem. So it really is gang warfare that's going on, and that's where the violence is coming from. The greater, sort of larger issue is how life has just been devalued in our wider culture, and it's really being seen in some of these neighborhoods, so that one person can say, hey, that guy is making it so I can't sell the cocaine or the marijuana that I want to sell.
Mm-hmm.
I know how to take care of this. Boom. I mean, and the answer is I'll just shoot that guy, and then the problem goes away.
Let's talk further in just moments. Pastor Cisco Cotto from Chicago on our guest line as we talk about Christians responding to urban inner city violence. It is ground zero there in Chicago. We'll continue in just a moment. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. It's 6:45. This is Austin Hill in the Morning. That's the program. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. Still to come, Secure Daughters, Confident Sons. We'll talk about raising children in a world gone awry with author Glenn Stanton. That's just ahead. Also, what to do without federally taxpayer-funded Obamacare subsidies. Some folks may have to figure out how to get along without that, given court rulings yesterday. Cisco Cotto is a pastor in the Chicago area. He's on our guest line here on the Faith Radio Network, talking about the hopelessness that surrounds that city right now. Cisco, what has emerged when you and other clergy from the Chicago area gather, recognizing that all the government programs and all the secular efforts, if you will, to try to stem the violence, they have failed, and we are wholly reliant on God to save us. What has come about as a result of being in that state and people gathering to call on him?
Well, you using the word hopelessness, that very much describes the situation as a lot of people see it. Random shootings, kids, practically every day a child being randomly shot by a stray bullet, a child killed because some gang member was upset at another gang member. That creates just the deepest sort of hopelessness that anyone can imagine when a parent is stuck in that situation and can't get their kids out of that situation. And so when we gather as pastors to pray fervently for God to do something in these neighborhoods, and then we go back and we talk to people who are experiencing this violence on a daily basis, what we can explain to them is, we are praying to God, and He is our ultimate hope. Ultimately, He's the only person who can really give us any hope. And as you can imagine, it's tough for people who have been stuck in this situation for a long time. They feel like God has forgotten them or God doesn't care about them. And so that's when we, as a large group of pastors from all around Chicagoland, get to say to them, no, we are united and wanting to let you know, we care about you, God cares about you, we are praying for this situation, and there is hope. And so some people respond to that positively, and they start to grasp the hope of God. And there are others, and I understand why it's so tough, there are others who are a bit more skeptical about whether or not God is really actually even thinking about them, much less caring about them.
What would you want your fellow Americans, your fellow Christians around the United States of America to do in response to this news?
There are wider cultural trends that I think often when we talk about these problems, it can seem as though we're pointing fingers, as though we're looking down, as though people who are in these neighborhoods have somehow created their own situation, and mm-hmm. It is their fault, and that allows some of us to stay disconnected from it, because we say, well, you know, it's their own fault, is what some people say overtly and some people kind of say in their mind. I think all around the country, people need to realize, Christians need to realize, that just like we are called to pray for Christian believers in Muslim countries who fear for their lives each and every day, we also have to pray, regardless of where you're listening to this broadcast. You need to pray, we beg you to pray, for people here in Chicago who, just like that believer in a Muslim country, is living in a dangerous place, not because they want to, not because they don't wish that they could move somewhere else, but because of finances, lack of resources, they're unable to get out of the situation. I just ask you, that's the one thing that everyone can do, is they can pray, and we treat that like a throwaway, Austin. You know, is that, well, I can't do anything else, so I guess I'll pray. But when we pray, we're calling on the greatest resource any of us could ever imagine to ask for help in a situation. So there's no way for anyone to send money. There's no way for anyone to, I guess they could move to Chicago and try to get involved, but obviously most people can't do that. But every single one of us can just pray for these violence-plagued communities and just beg God to do something to heal it.
Pastor Cisco Cotto, he's from the Chicago area of Oak Park. Pastor, thanks so much for joining us. It's good to hear your voice again. We'll look forward to being in touch again soon. We'll make sure to post links on our blog page to your church website and to your blog, and we'll be back in touch again soon, and we'll be praying. Thank you.
Thank you, Austin. It's great to have you talking about something so important.
6:53, this is Austin Hill in the Morning. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. Our program continues in moments. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Live the Promise with Susie Larson is now in a new two-hour format, weekday afternoons 3 till 5. Yesterday on her program, Susie shared from her book, The Uncommon Woman. Let's listen in.
You know, I have three grown sons, are all married, and I've made a lot of jokes about my middle son. He was our strong-willed kid who lived in the corner. I mean, he had a permanent chair there with his name on it, not really, but almost, because he challenged us at every turn, and he was just strong-willed and snarky. Well, then our third son was just the softest, sweetest little thing, and he would go around a bug before he'd step on a bug, and he was just that sweet kid. And like at his birthday party as a little guy, he'd get all these gifts, and then he'd turn around and redistribute them because he wanted everybody to go home happy. And I thought, wow, what a sweet, generous kid. But I remember one day, we're at McDonald's, and he wanted to go back in line and get his own order of fries. And he wanted to be a big boy. I think he was probably four, and he's holding a crinkled dollar bill, and I'm keeping a mom's eye on him at a distance, and he's just kind of insecure and sweet. And one by one, people are butting in line and getting in front of him, and he's just sheepishly backing up, getting farther and farther away from the counter, not closer to it. So I went over to him, honey, what's going on? And he just shrugged his shoulders, I don't know. And we realized at that moment, though he's sweet and generous, he was also insecure. And you know what? We start to pump him full of truth. We were like, hon, if you are shy because you have less to say, that's okay. But if you are quiet and insecure because you think you're less than, not okay. Because God made you in his image. And when he looks at you, his heart beats out of his chest. He loves you so much. Your opinion matters. And if you feel always, like everybody else is above you, you're kind of in a hole and everybody else is on the level ground. And if you believe that, every choice you make will be to get out of that hole. Well, guess what? You're not in a hole because Jesus died to make you whole. And you are beautiful and wonderful to him. So if you're in a room where everybody else likes red and you're the only guy who likes blue, blue is a great color for you. He gave you a voice. He gave you tastes. He gave you an opinion for a purpose. And if you believe a lie your whole life, every choice you make will be to make up for that lie. But if you believe the truth about yourself, that's when you're going to go on and do and be everything God intended you to be. Well, over time, we start to see him believe it. You know, we start to see him go, hey, how about if we play this game? And just sort of assert his opinion. And we said to him, you know, you're not better than anybody, but you are not less than. And so over time, we start to see him just get his own voice and his own opinion. Well, months later, we're back at McDonald's, and this time he wanted an ice cream cone all by himself. So I'm keeping a distance, watching my boy with his dollar bill in his hand, wrinkled it up, just holding it tight. And wouldn't you know, one by one by one, these teenagers are butting in front of him, and he's going farther and farther away from the counter. And I'm exasperated. And so I go up to him, honey, have we taught you nothing? You know? And he's like, oh, no, Mom, it's not what you think. I know I could keep my place in line if I wanted. It's just that all these people look hungrier than me. And like a flash of lightning, I saw that passage from Philippians. It says, Jesus did not consider equality with God a thing to be grasped, but he laid his life down. I want you to think about that. Jesus did not consider equality with God something to leverage to his advantage. Now, almost anybody you ever meet that's got status or position is at least tempted at some point to leverage their status and position in a way that benefits them and makes you pay. Jesus didn't consider his equality with God as something to leverage in a way that he benefited so that you would pay. He did the opposite.
Susie Larson, host of Live the Promise, weekday afternoons 3 to 5, talking about her book, The Uncommon Woman. That was from yesterday's broadcast. Coming up this afternoon, her guests will be Dr. Les and Leslie Parrott, talking about learning to laugh our way through conflict. Yes, it can be done. We can soften the bump, so to speak. That's this afternoon from 3 to 5 on Live the Promise with Susie Larson. Right here, 3 to 5 Central on the Faith Radio Network. It's 6:58. I'm Austin Hill. Still to come, let's talk about the biblical virtues of business. 67 great biblical ideas about business. We'll find out about those with our friend Bill English from BibleandBusiness.com. Also, raising secure daughters and confident sons in the midst of a world gone awry. That sounds like a really great idea. We'll talk with author Glenn Stanton about that. This and more just ahead. I'm Austin Hill. The news is next.
Start your day connecting faith to life. It's Austin Hill in the morning.
Good morning, 7:04. I am Austin Hill. Thank you for listening. This is the Faith Radio Network. I'm here weekday mornings 6 till 8, where we talk about things that truly do matter as we seek to connect faith to our everyday lives and see the world through the lenses of our Christian faith. Coming up later this hour, raising secure daughters and confident sons. If you're a parent or you're a grandparent, you want to listen to this very, very carefully. And even if you are not a parent in any way, even just out of a care and concern for our world, for our country, for our culture, and perhaps the kids in your church, you want to listen up as author Glenn Stanton weighs in just about half an hour from now. Secure Daughters, Confident Sons. We'll talk about how to genuinely raise a generation like that. That's forthcoming. Also, what sense can we make, if any, about the court rulings, two conflicting federal court rulings yesterday regarding the federal Obamacare law. Will the U.S. federal governments, combined with state governments, will they continue to distribute taxpayer-funded government subsidies that enable people to buy health insurance, or will they not? We just don't know. There's a lot of uncertainty surrounding that. So if you or somebody you know in your family and your church is relying on the taxpayer-funded subsidies for health insurance, be forewarned. We just don't know how reliable that's going to be, but we'll try to make some sense of that coming up in later this hour here on Austin Hill in the Morning. In moments, our great friend Bill English from BibleAndBusiness.com. He has published a list of irrefutable truths. I'm kind of trumping this up. He hasn't used such highfalutin language, but they are nonetheless irrefutable truths about business. Christian business in particular. So you head out to your workplace, to your vocation, your calling. Stand by. We'll tell you about some irrefutable truths that make business from a Christian perspective happen. Bill English up next on Austin Hill in the Morning. Morning 7:07. This is the Faith Radio Network. We appreciate you listening live real time. I'm here weekday mornings 6 till 8. I'm Austin Hill. It's Austin Hill in the Morning. Find us anytime, of course, on our mobile friendly website, myfaithradio.com. My next guest is no stranger to Faith Radio listeners. The founder and CEO of MindSharp Incorporated. He's also the creator of BibleAndBusiness.com. He joins us most every week, actually, to share his insights on the marketplace and on business in general. Bill English from BibleAndBusiness.com joins us on the guest line. Bill, welcome back to the program. Hope your week is going well thus far.
Well, it is. Good morning, Austin, and happy Wednesday to you.
And to you as well. You've published this very striking list on BibleAndBusiness.com. You've entitled this 67 Undeniable Truths of Christian Business Ownership. I'm calling them irrefutable. Perhaps undeniable and irrefutable are kind of synonymous. But I want to start by asking you about number 67 on the list, not the number one.
Oh, you're going all the way to the bottom.
I'm going to the bottom, and I don't, you know, it seems to me you've numbered these things. They're all so important and so profound. But number 67, all wealth comes from profitable businesses. All the money that exists, all the wealth, genuine wealth, not just currency, but the genuine wealth that exists in the world, comes from profitable, not non-profit, but for-profit, successful business enterprise. Explain that, if you would, Bill English.
Well, I think it's self-evident, quite frankly. When you look at how wealth is generated throughout the Bible and just throughout world history, you will find that it is generated in environments where people are allowed to have private property, they're allowed to build businesses, and they have the skills and the expertise to make those businesses profitable, and that is how you generate wealth. It's an expanding money supply, obviously, and an expanding markets, obviously. The governments are not overly extractive of the wealth, and so they leave the majority of the wealth, sometimes the vast majority of the wealth, in the hands of the population rather than taking it on themselves. And to the extent that you have those elements, with profitable businesses being at the core, to the extent that you have those elements, you're going to have wealth. And it doesn't really matter which culture, which time period, that's how wealth is generated.
Now, what do you say to the person who says, but wait a minute, the United States Department of Agriculture, our federal government, they provide people with food stamps. They've got plenty of wealth to provide food subsidies for people who can't afford it. The United States Department of Health and Human Services, they have Medicaid for people who can't afford health care. There's wealth in other places. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's actually a redistribution of wealth. That's not the creation of wealth. The United States government could not pass out food stamps or give subsidies in the Affordable Health Care Act without business first generating the wealth that is taxable so that the government would have the money to perform those redistributions in the first place.
Hmm. Bill English, publisher of BibleAndBusiness.com. He himself a tech entrepreneur. He's on the Newsline here on Austin Hill in the Morning on the Faith Radio Network. He's published a very striking list, 67 Undeniable Truths of Christian Business Ownership, and he's talking about them with us. This is very interesting. Some endings are necessary, number 61 on the list. That is to say, I guess what you're saying here, Bill English, is that businesses have life cycles, and sometimes businesses are just naturally going to come to an end, I guess. Explain that, if you would.
Yeah, actually they are. Some businesses do run their course, and they're no longer needed by the market. You can look at Kodak. Go back, say, 20, 25 years ago, Kodak Film was an incredible business nationally, multi-billion-dollar-a-year business. Today, hardly anybody buys film.
Yeah, today our teenagers are saying, what in the world is film?
Yeah, what's a dark room? And how do you know? I did dark rooms. So, and I remember those days processing film and printing pictures and all that, but that's an example of a business that has just run its life cycle in its course, and due to technology changes, that particular business is no longer needed. But I actually wrote that, Austin, from a perspective of personal relationships. Some relationships in businesses should not be continued and should end. And that goes against a little bit my own Christian beliefs that, and I, in some ways I think I'm Pollyannish on this, that through Jesus Christ all relationships can be made whole and be made harmonious and things like that. But I have learned through experience that no matter how much you pray through some relationships, that they're just toxic. Mm-hmm. And you just need to end them and move on. And unless that other person is willing to come forward and have the same type of transformation process in the relationship, sometimes it's just best that you end them and move on. So some relationships, some businesses should be ended.
Bill English is the publisher of BibleAndBusiness.com. He himself, actually a seminary graduate, but a tech entrepreneur as well. He's published the 67 Undeniable Truths About Business, biblically-based Christian business principles. Number 39, servant leadership does not work when the one being served is arrogant or rebellious. Wow. Tell us about that, Bill English.
Well, that's actually a corollary to the rule that some relationships should end.
Yeah.
You know, Christ came to serve us, right? But that relationship, that personal relationship with Jesus Christ doesn't work if we're arrogant and rebellious and we spurn what Jesus has done and is trying to do for us, right? By the same token, if you buy into the servant model, the servant leadership model of leadership within a business, that's great, but that doesn't mean that everything's going to work well.
Hmm.
What it really means is that some people are just not going to be served due to their arrogance.
All right, Bill English from BibleAndBusiness.com on the Newsline. Bill, I know you're out of town on a business trip. Got to take a quick break. Can you hold on for more?
Yeah, no worries.
Okay, stand by. We'll continue with Bill English in just a moment. There's 67 of these profound ideas here. We won't cover all of them, but we'll get to more coming up next. You're listening to Austin Hill in the Morning. This is the Faith Radio Network. It's 7:14. Raising secure daughters and confident sons. What a concept. What a tall order, right? We'll talk about it coming up in just about half an hour from now with author Glenn Stanton here on Austin Hill in the Morning on the Faith Radio Network. I'm glad you're listening. It's now 7:17 Central Time, and I'm here weekday morning 6 till 8. Bill English is actually a seminary graduate. He's an MDiv, Master of Divinity, but he's also the CEO of MindSharp. He is a tech entrepreneur. He publishes BibleAndBusiness.com. He's published a very striking article called The 67 Undeniable Truths of Christian Business Ownership. I want to ask you about numbers 28 and 29 on your list, Bill English. Number 28 is, your business must be profitable. And number 29, profits are good. Now, we live in this era where, my goodness, from some of the most powerful sections of our society, we have people lamenting on profitable businesses, bashing profitable businesses. Oh my goodness, this company was profitable, and isn't that terrible? They're successful while other people are unsuccessful. How do you begin in the context of our current cultural milieu, Bill English? How do you address this issue of profits?
Well, I address it by saying first that a business that's not profitable is not going to last. Unless it's a government entity that through the force of law can extract money out of you and me, it's not going to last. And it really doesn't matter, quite frankly, if it's a non-profit or a for-profit. If it's not profitable, it's not going to last. So secondly, profits are good. They are a social good. They provide the ability for the business to grow, invest, do research, create new products, new services, and create new jobs. Profits are the direct link, or maybe I should say the global context in which job creation happens. Governments don't create jobs. Presidents don't create jobs. I never believed that Bush created any jobs any more than I think Obama does. Governments don't create jobs. They might create work, but they don't create jobs. And I think that that when you have profitable businesses, you're going to have excellent job creation in the marketplace. And that's good for everybody.
Bill English, in your, I guess this is an admonition to business leaders, business owners perhaps, number 14 on your list, rumors. You'll be the last one to hear them. Tell us about rumors in the workplace.
You know, Austin, I know you've run a few businesses. I believe that the day you hire your first employee as a small business owner is the day you stop knowing everything about your business. And rumors happen within companies when they're growing and especially when they're downsizing.
Mm-hmm.
People start to get on that rumor mill. Am I going to be laid off? Are layoffs coming? Something like that. Or who is he hiring next? And am I going to like this person? Do I have to work with them? What are they going to do? Rumors just happen. People don't tend to share rumors with the owners. They just don't. So just understand that there's probably talk going on in your business that you don't know about, and so sometimes you have to walk around your business and find out kind of what the scuttlebutt is. And I always called it walking around and finding out what I said recently. That's what I called it.
Walking around, finding out what I said recently. Bill English, publisher of BibleAndBusiness.com. He's on the guest line here on Austin Hill in the Morning on the Faith Radio Network. I guess maybe closely akin to the idea you're purporting here about rumors. Here's another one, and I've addressed this at times on my program, Austin Hill's Big World of Small Business, but again, I guess an admonition to business owners, you will be misunderstood, misrepresented, and misinterpreted. That's number 15 on your list. And number 16, people can and will lie to you. I see a great counseling book in the works here. It's like the world is unfair, people misbehave, get over it. But tell us more about where you're going with these two undeniable truths.
Well, the reality is that when you're at the top of an organization, you're probably one of the few, if not the only, person in the organization who has access to all of the information necessary to understand the big picture of what's happening. When you go talk to CEOs, look, I know you talk to them on a regular basis, Austin, with your show, and just you know, personally, I know that you do this. They will tell you that there are some decisions that have to be made by the CEO simply because that's the only position that has all the information. And when those decisions are made, oftentimes those decisions are misunderstood within certain segments of the business, because from that segment's viewpoint, the decision just doesn't make sense. And so the scuttlebutt starts, and there's misrepresentations and misinterpretations. People just don't have access to everything. So this is why I think, by the way, it's dangerous for us to question some presidents' decisions, simply because we don't have this access to the same information that they do. And I don't care whether they're Democrat or Republican.
Well, your point's well taken. Another point on your list here is that businesses are not democracies. And as you're describing the structure of governance in a company, whether it's a locally owned small business or a large corporation, they most certainly are not representative, governmental, democratic sort of processes that are in place here. I'm reminded, too, of situations I've seen come up in churches where an elder board makes a decision or a pastor makes a decision, and people protest and say, well, that's not what I wanted, or, you know, they didn't ask me. And that's, you know, just because we have state legislatures and city councils and a U.S. Congress doesn't mean that every power epicenter or authoritative entity in our culture operates that way. I think that's part of your point anyway.
Yeah, it is. And I'm finding that most of my legislators and governors and presidents don't ask me anyways what I think. So,
right.
no, seriously, a church is not a democracy. A business is not a democracy. Decision-making authority is oftentimes diffused and federated throughout the organization, but sometimes it is not. And business owners need to be okay with that. They don't have to get consensus on every decision before they move forward.
Bill English, he is a CEO, a tech entrepreneur. He's also the publisher of BibleAndBusiness.com. We'll make sure to post the link to one of his latest entries here, 67 Undeniable Truths of Christian Business Ownership. And Bill, you are a voice of reason in troubled times. Thanks for this list. This took some very creative thinking, but this is some real wisdom here. Thanks for joining us. Safe travels. We'll look forward to seeing you again soon.
Hey, thanks, Austin. Have a good day.
7:24. This is Austin Hill in the Morning. You're listening to the Faith Radio Network. Still to come, raising secure daughters and confident sons. Wow, it's... this is not the parenting terrain of your own parents and grandparents. We're in some uncharted waters, those of us living in the United States of America right now. We'll talk with author Glenn Stanton about that very enterprise, that very challenge with our kids as we continue. It's 7:25. This is the Faith Radio Network. Good morning and welcome to it. It's Austin Hill in the Morning. That's me. I'm here weekday morning 6 till 8 on the Faith Radio Network. As we seek to connect faith to our everyday lives and make sense of the world around us, we seek to be informative, challenging, hopeful, and helpful as we go about our daily lives. Thank you for being here. We appreciate that. Still to come, we've got an update on some of the uncertainty, more uncertainty, another layer of it, if you will, surrounding the federal Obamacare agenda and those who are relying on federal taxpayer-funded subsidies to buy health insurance. That could be in question after two federal courts rulings yesterday. It most certainly is. I'll get you updated on the very latest in just moments. What is the proper goal of parenting? Well, that's probably an entire episode of our program right there to list all the objectives of good parenting. How about this? Raising secure daughters and confident sons. That's probably a good place to start, wouldn't you say? My next guest has authored a book with that title, Secure Daughters, Confident Sons. He's the director of family formation studies at Focus on the Family in Colorado Springs, also a research fellow at the Institute of Marriage and Family in Ottawa, Ontario. Glenn Stanton joins us on the guest line. Glenn Stanton, welcome to the Faith Radio Network in Austin Hill in the Morning. Good to talk to you, sir.
Hey, Austin, it's good to be with you, and thank you for having me.
Always a pleasure to hear your voice. Secure Daughters, Confident Sons. Wow, this is a great title. It certainly captivates my mind as a parent. What got you started with a working title like that? What sort of need were you trying to address when you set out to write this?
Well, primarily it's centered in, I think, what's a big issue today, and that is just boys and girls, I mean, and the difference there. How do we take little boys and grow them into good men? And how do we take little girls and grow them into good women? And what does that even mean? And primarily the idea of there are a bunch of different ways for a good man to be a good man and a bunch of different ways for a good woman to be a good woman. You know, there's not this kind of black and white, okay, this is what a man is, this is what a woman is. And parents need to know that as they're raising their little boys and little girls. And basically it's about helping them become confident and secure in who they are, how God wired them to be, the unique individual that he made them to be. And then how we as parents, mothers and fathers, as, you know, as sex-distinct parents, how do we engage in that? How do we participate in that as men and women? And how do we contribute? What is our special role there?
Hmm. Glenn Stanton, I note your carefully chosen words there, sex-distinct parents or gender-distinct parents. You're articulating an idea that I believe is quite biblical, quite historic, the idea that fathers... Men who are fathers, they bring something very unique and distinct to the parenting equation. And mothers who are female, they bring something very distinct and separate apart from the men. Tell us about that.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, you know, even as you're saying that, you know, you can think if this were, you know, 30 years ago, people changing the dial like, okay, tell me people, you know, need oxygen to live. I mean, it just sounds so obvious, right? But today this is being so tremendously challenged in the idea of, well, people are just people and gender and sex doesn't really matter. Well, it does matter. And this is this is just not an advice book at all. This is really a research book where it's one of the books that has taken me the longest to write because of just all the information that's out there in the research showing us that dads parent in a particular way and moms parent in a particular way. And what's curious is that often creates, you know, disagreement among mothers and fathers. Why can't he do it like I do it? Why can't she do it like I do it? But the research says that both of those different ways are necessary and that our children benefit from both of these different ways. And then the book is, you know, just chock full of examples of you know, just what I mean by that, and then how children, boys and girls, benefit from mom and dad's different ways of parenting.
Glenn Stanton, author of the book Secure Daughters, Confident Sons, How Parents Guide Their Children into Authentic Masculinity and Femininity. He's on our guest line here on the Faith Radio Network. Glenn, I'm wondering, are you writing or did you write this book in such a way to address an observed problem on your behalf? In other words, are we raising daughters that are insecure in our culture and sons who are not confident? Is that part of the motivation here?
Well, that's hugely part of the motivation, you know, because it's you're right. I mean, if children aren't getting these basic things that they need, being raised by a man, being raised by a woman, you know, as men and women, then, you know, they tend to grow up with a bit of a lack there. And daughters need that security. I mean, that's the one of the things that is true about femininity is they want to be protected. They want to be cared for. They want to know that, that they're secure. Boys want to be confident. They want to know that they've got what it takes, that they can solve the problem. You know, you think about any hero of a boy, it's the guy who goes out and does it, you know, gets it done. And that doesn't have to be like a John Wayne type. It can be, you know, like even a Bill Gates type, you know. I mean, again, there's different ways of being a good man. But each of those guys went out and, you know, tamed the wild, you know, and they did what they had to do and they created something new and they solved problems and things like that. And boys want to know how to do that. They want to know how to change the landscape, how to fix things, how to make things better, how to help other people.
Glenn Stanton, it strikes me that at least over the last decade or so, there has been this conversation going on in some circles anyway, within the evangelical Christian community, perhaps in the Catholic Christian community as well, about how maybe these substantive and very historically grounded ideas about masculinity don't come up, at least not often enough, in church circles. I remember being at a men's group meeting at a particular evangelical church, it's probably 6 or 8 years ago, where a gentleman got up and stood up and spoke, and he said, you know, for all of my life in church, I've been taught all the things that I'm not supposed to do. I've been defined by who I am not. I don't cuss. I don't look at women lustfully. I don't drink in excess. I don't smoke. I don't hurt anybody's feelings. I don't offend. I don't get angry. I don't. I'm trying to figure out, who has God made me to be? Who am I? What do I do? And I think there's probably some truth to that, and there's been some other authors who've written about that subject. Are you attempting to address maybe a shortcoming, if you will, in the Christian community and add to the broader discussion here?
You know what, Austin, that's very, very well said, and that's exactly right. Men know what not to be, but we don't know, you know, what we should be. In fact, you know, you should be a good man is one of the most nonsensical statements that we have out there today, because we just don't know what that means. And it's exactly as you said. And that is exactly what I'm writing about. But there's another angle to that. And to be honest, I am in a way responding to or arguing against some of the manhood books out there that say, well, a man is a man that goes out into the wild. A man is a man that, you know, does outdoor activities that are dangerous. You know, there are a lot of men that are good men that just simply don't do that, mm-hmm. you know. They're, and they can be good men. So it's not that a good man is a particular stereotype of a man. A good man is a man, and, you know, and this may be a little bit simplistic, but I think it's largely true. A man does what needs to be done in the way that it needs to be done at the time that it needs doing. You know, you think about, you know, we celebrated manhood at 9/11. You know, we saw very clearly men doing what men do. It wasn't stereotypical. It wasn't like, you know, action movies. It was, you know, these guys put their lives on the line. And it's interesting that nobody said, well, what about the women? How come the women can't do that kind of thing? You know what? Mm-hmm. It was the women who were saying, these guys stepped up and put their lives on the line, rushed into these buildings, cared for people, protected people. That's what men do. And, you know, fathers need to be able to teach that to their kids. Men in this society just need to exemplify that. And, you know, it starts with basic manners, even holding the door open for people. And that's very key that men need to understand.
Glenn Stanton, author of Secure Daughters, Confident Sons, How Parents Guide Their Children into Authentic Masculinity and Femininity. He's my guest here on the Faith Radio Network. Glenn, stand by. We'll continue in a moment. We'll ask Glenn about parenting kids into authentic masculinity and femininity, even in the midst of a culture where masculine and feminine are horribly confused. We'll talk about that next. 7:45, it's the Faith Radio Network. I'm Austin Hill. Don't go away. On this, the Faith Radio Network, I'm Austin Hill, here weekday morning 6 till 8. My guest is Glenn Stanton, author of the book Secure Daughters, Confident Sons, How Parents Guide Their Children into Authentic Masculinity and Femininity. Glenn Stanton, you're no stranger to talking about the very confusing and perplexing culture that we live in currently. And in fact, you sort of alluded to us, this discussion about authentic masculinity and femininity might have been a bizarre conversation with our parents or certainly our grandparents' generation, but it's necessary today. And here we are in the year 2014. where gender is thought to be nothing more than sort of my subjective perception about how I feel today. If I feel feminine, if I feel like a woman, if I feel like a woman trapped in a man's body or what have you, well, that's who I am. There is nothing absolute. There's no birth identity involved with gender any longer. It's a very subjective sort of thing. How do we go about raising kids in that sort of very confusing and perplexing cultural milieu?
Well, and you're absolutely right. And first of all, I mean, I deal a lot with that in the culture here at Focus on the Family, going out and speaking on that topic. And what's ironic about it is this whole idea is coming up at the very time when some of the most sophisticated science is telling us just the opposite, that maleness and femaleness are real things and that they are wired into our brains. There's a male and female brain. There's, you know, it's deep into our DNA, and parents need to understand that they as male parents, they as female parents are distinct things and that they have a very important role. I mean, you know, just a quick example here is even early in life, the scholars, the researchers are showing us, look at a mom and a dad when they, you know, get a new little infant, a new little toddler. The mother tends to hold the baby close to her. Mm-hmm. You know, you think about her physicality, okay? That's, you know, she holds the baby close to feed that baby, and she is just tender to that child. Now, the father is as well, but the father is so much more likely to tickle the baby, to, you know, wiggle the baby, to shake the baby. And this other odd thing that we see all over the world is throw the baby up in the air. And it, you know, it can freak mom out, but it's not just simply that dad throws the child up in the air. You've got to think about what that child is experiencing. Okay, nice, warm, close, tender with mom. That builds security. That builds comfort. That builds, you know what, somebody loves me here. To take dad, okay, he's stimulating the child, tickling the child, throwing the child up in the air. That gets their body moving. It gets them excited. But when they go up in the air, everybody knows the first couple of times that that happens, they, you know, just stop breathing. They gasp like, oh, my goodness, this world is a scary place. But then they come back down into dad's arms, and what happens? They always giggle.
Mm-hmm.
And if they can start talking, they say, again, what they have just learned is to take a risk. And now they come down, and they thought, that risk was awesome. You know, it's there's a whole amusement park industry based on that human reality. And mothers and fathers do that in different ways. And basically, again, father's way is building confidence, building security that, you know what, I can take chances. And life is all about chances. You know what? I mean, you've got to go get on the school bus all by yourself one day. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, you've got to go approach, you know, new kids to make friends. And that, you know, those things are critical. So things that are just a normal part of mom life and dad life, we don't think, oh, they really matter. But you know what? They matter in huge ways because moms and dads are wired differently. And that's just one example among many, many that, you know, it's not just for American kids or Western kids or parents. This is true of parents all over the world.
Secure Daughters, Confident Sons. That's the title of the book by our guest Glenn Stanton. He's on the guest line here on Austin Hill in the Morning on the Faith Radio Network. At the end of the day, are things moving collectively among Christians in America? Are things moving in a positive direction, would you say, Glenn Stanton, in terms of our understandings and our applications of biblical parenting wisdom, or maybe not so much?
You know, I always try to be positive. It beats the alternative, but I'm not positive about this one, primarily because, I, unfortunately, too much of the church is buying into this idea. Well, you know, the male and female thing isn't such a big thing. We're human beings. God made us as human beings, and we're all unique and distinct. But no, at the end of the day, there's we don't have an imagination. We don't have a picture, a theology even, of what it means to be male and female. And that's a huge point. God says, let us make man in our image according to our likeness. And the next verse, in the image of God he made them male and female. It doesn't just say in the image of God he made them human, he made them. but male and female. There's something deep, beautiful, wonderful, and even divine within humanity in the maleness and femaleness of all of them. And that is really kind of what this book is about. Although it's a practical book for parents, it's tapping us as Christians on the shoulders and really saying, okay, this thing that God said about male and female, it means incredibly wonderful, rich, deep, and very daily practical things about you as a parent and about this little child. And the child that you are raising is only one of two models. It's either a boy or a girl. Mm. And how do you, as a sex-distinct parent, raise that little boy or little girl to be a good man and a good woman one day? There is another family out there who is expecting you to do that well, because that child of yours is going to most likely be that child's spouse. And so they want that little boy, that little girl to grow up to be a good man and a good woman.
Some great, great long-term, broad-based thinking. Glenn Stanton, author, Secure Daughters, Confident Sons. Glenn, thanks for what you do. Thanks for your time this morning. We'll look forward to talking about this all-important issue again with you very, very soon.
Hey, Austin, thanks for having me on. I appreciate being with your listeners.
7:53, this is Austin Hill in the Morning on the Faith Radio Network. Faith Radio Network. Thank you for being here. I am Austin Hill, here weekday morning 6 till 8. Find us anytime, by the way, at myfaithradio.com. In fact, if you were intrigued with my previous guest just moments ago, well, we'll have that whole conversation, our whole dialogue with Glenn Stanton on our blog page at myfaithradio.com. Later today, we'll have the other interview guests that we've spoken with today on our blog as well, myfaithradio.com. If you or somebody you know, perhaps in your family, maybe folks in your church, are relying on the federal Obamacare program, or what is more officially known as the Affordable Care Act, the ACA, the federal law, if you're relying on that to provide taxpayer-funded subsidies to you or your family members so you can buy health insurance, that is seriously called into question as of today. Yesterday, in a 2-1 decision, a United States Court of Appeals in the District of Columbia ruled that a key provision, the provision that allows federally funded tax-subsidized subsidies or tax-funded subsidies for people to buy health insurance, the court ruled that that is unconstitutional. Now, without getting into all the minutia here of the legalese involved here, this specifically applies to the healthcare insurance exchange websites that are relying on the federal platform. There are some of the Obamacare insurance exchange websites that are more or less run by the individual states across the country. They all ultimately tie back to the federal government. There is no completely autonomous state-based insurance exchange in the country, but some of them have greater modicums of autonomy than others. The Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C. ruled that those that distribute taxpayer-funded insurance subsidies vis-a-vis the federal platform are unconstitutional. Whole bunch of reasons that they offered for that, but that's the thumbnail sketch of what happened. Now, as if that isn't perplexing and disturbing enough, that was yesterday morning in a U.S. Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., in the District of Columbia. About 2.5, 3-hour drive south of Washington, D.C., in Richmond, Virginia, later in the day yesterday, another U.S. Court of Appeals in Richmond, they overturned that ruling, or at least they ruled that what happened at the court in Washington, D.C. was itself wrong. The analysis tells us, and most legal experts are saying, this is really bad news for those relying on taxpayer-funded subsidies by health insurance, and this could be a serious, serious problem for the federal Obamacare agenda moving forward. That said, if you were intending that you or family members or people in your church would just kind of go to the government to get their stuff, so to speak, it's not proving to be a reliable source. Stand by for more and consider yourself for more. Have a great day. I'm Austin Hill. See you tomorrow morning at 6. Thanks for listening to this podcast from Austin Hill in the Morning. For more information about this, you can visit Austin Hill in the Morning, our program page, on MyFaithRadio.com. That's MyFaithRadio.com.